Dispatch, pockets of fire all around.
Dear Chief, much has happened since we last spoke. Welcome to Dear Chief Podcast, where your hosts and their guests share the 411 of being married to the people who respond to 911s. Take a peek into fire family life and get unabashed advice on how to prevent forest fires in your marriage. Now, here's your hosts, two seasoned fire wives, Audra and Chelsea.
Welcome back, it's raining and freaking California still, but Chelsea's here today, even though she's a little bit underwater. So welcome back, Chelsea.
Thanks. I think maybe the weather's getting better. Maybe not. I don't know. But we're not here to talk about the weather. We are here with Davin Cole today.
Davin Cole is a retired lieutenant with 33 years in law enforcement from the San Francisco Bay Area. He has worked in various capacities, including FTO, gang enforcement, plainclothes. For 15 years, was a canine officer and trainer. In the last 5 years, he was the LT of Homeless Outreach Unit and Pre-Arrest Diversion Program Lead Initiative. I don't know what any of that is because I'm married to a firefighter. So Davin had an on-duty injury that led to decades-long prescription pain medication addiction, and later to include alcohol addiction. Davin has taken his life-altering experiences and turned them into a platform for advocacy, focusing on addiction and mental wellness among first responders, having found sobriety and purpose in sharing his story, aiming to educate, inspire, and offer solidarity to those facing similar changes. That was a mouthful, but I got it.
You got it out.
Let's dive into your story. Give us the details.
Sure. Like you said, I've been a police officer for over 31 years here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Was in the canine unit for 15 years, 10 years of those. I was the trainer. Got bit pretty severely by one of the dogs during a training exercise, which ironically wasn't even supposed to be a biting exercise. It was a obedience, you know, a tactical obedience, because in the law enforcement community, if you add tactical to the front of it, it makes it sound like a cooler training day. So dog came up. Got a good chunk of my leg out, and that kind of started things for me. This was almost 14 years ago when they were still giving out pain medications like Pez candies. So my pain manager had no problem giving me as many as I needed. And initially, I wasn't addicted. I had pain. I had nerve damage to that leg. And so the pain was definitely there, and I needed the medication. But as we moved forward, after about 3 years in, they were finally able to go in and repair some of the damage. Now, there was a point that I was told I would never be out of pain. A neurologist, when I'd asked him at one of my follow-up appointments, you know, what was the long-term prognosis going to be with the leg originally, he told me, well, this is about as good as it gets. And at that point, I was in chronic pain. I was waking up in pain. I was going to bed in pain. Really, all the opioids were doing was making it tolerable and allowing me to get to work. But fortunately, I had a good pain manager, and she kept pushing, trying to find a surgeon that could go in and repair the damage. And they did. They cleaned off that scar tissue and they freed up that nerve and the pain went away. And so my pain manager decides, you know, we're going to wean me off of the pain meds. She says, you know, we're going to take about 2 months. We're going to wean you off slow so you don't go through any withdrawals. And as we're getting down to those last week or so of weaning down, and I was at a high of like 12 pills a day. And now I'm down to like two a day, one a day. And that's when I realized I was addicted. I didn't want to stop taking the meds. I missed the feeling. I missed what it was doing for me, or what I thought mentally it was doing for me. And this was right around the same time that workers' comp was closing out the case. And so they closed out my case. I left the pain manager, went back to my regular family doctor. And, you know, we had a good relationship. And, you know, as soon as I started seeing him again, he asked me how the leg was doing. I was like, oh, it's horrible. It's still painful. And I'm in pain every day. And he's like, oh, okay, no problem. And he starts up the scripts again. And I'm back up to, you know, 8-10 pills a day on a prescription. And I go through that. And as time goes on, it was a lot easier back in the day to get a refill. You could usually get it about 10 days in advance. So even if I was running out, which I pretty much had never made it before the end of the month, I was running out after about 20, 25 days, the laws started to change. It started to get harder. You know, went down to you couldn't refill 5 days in advance, and you couldn't refill three. And then it became, you know, you couldn't refill until the day before. And that's when I really started struggling as far as, you know, overusing the medication. So after that, I just started, you know, seeking out family and friends. There's always somebody, especially in the first responder community, I know in law enforcement, there's always somebody that's gotten hurt and they don't like taking their pain meds because it makes them nauseous or they don't like the feeling. And they're more than happy to give it to you. You know, they know about your pain and you tell them, oh yeah, those things are great for me. And they're like, oh, you could have mine. And you know, you go to family, my mom, you know, she was on some pretty high prescription pain meds and she had no problem taking care of her baby boy and made sure that he wasn't in pain. And but the addiction was really spiraling out of control. About 5 years into the addiction, I added alcohol to it because, you know, the pain meds weren't enough anymore. So I needed alcohol, and vodka seemed like a great choice to take with opioids. And as time went on, it got a bigger and bigger struggle. You know, they talk about being a functional addict. It's kind of I think a misnomer, because are you really functioning? You know, I was going to work every day. I didn't drink at work. I didn't take pills at work. I had this, you know, moral compass that I told myself that, you know, even though I'm an addict, I'm not on the street. I'm not sleeping at a tent. I'm not messing up at work. Everything's fine. I'm able to take care of my family. I'm making good money. We're going on vacations. Life's good. You know, this addiction just kind of is something I'm dealing with. But after a while, the depression hit. At that time, I didn't realize I had some undiagnosed PTSD, but the depression started to get bad. And in the last 6 months, and before everything collapsed on me, the suicidal thoughts started coming. And it was almost a nightly thought of like, I can't do this anymore. I can't keep drinking. I can't keep taking these pills. I got to stop. And, you know, I'll do it on my own though, because I don't need anybody's help. You know, I'm a cop. I take care of people. I'll take care of myself. You know, and I try to convince myself, you know, if you can stop drinking the alcohol, you know, that'll be step one. And then you'll wean yourself off of the pills, and that'll be step two. But, you know, those are lies that those who have substance abuse disorders tell themselves, you know, is that, you know, we'll fix it, especially in the first responder community, right? We are probably the last ones to ever ask for help. And then there's just the stigma of it behind it, of having to admit that you have a problem and that it's affecting you. So that continued on. The last couple of weeks before I was arrested, which is ultimately what happened to me, the suicidal ideations were getting bad. You know, I kept telling myself I was going to do that to my wife. I was going to do that to my two daughters. I knew that children of parents who committed suicide had a much higher rate of committing suicides themselves, you know, so I told myself I wouldn't do that to them. So I just started planning to make it not look like a suicide. There's an area in the Bay Area called Devil's Slide. You know, a lot of people crash there. You don't survive. It's a pretty steep dive off of a cliff into the ocean. And so that's what I started thinking I was going to do, you know, that I would just drive myself off of the cliff and end it. And, you know, I would tell myself, that's crazy. Don't think like that. You know, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd be sober and I'd be like, wow, you know, don't stop thinking like that. Just go ask for help. And honestly, the department I worked for has probably one of the best employee assistance programs and peer support programs. I easily could have called our sergeant in charge of our peer support program. I could have called him at 3 a.m. and said, hey, you know, I need help. I need to go get cleaned up. I'm addicted to these pain meds. And my department would have given me 30 days off family leave, no question asked. They want to know where you are. They don't want to know why you're there. They just want to know that you're working on it and that you stepped up and asked for help yourself. There would have been zero repercussions. I would have went, successfully completed the program, and then the sergeant would have cleared me back for duty, and I'd go back to my assignment. And nobody would be none the wiser, but I couldn't do it. You know, I just couldn't ask for help. And every night was just a battle with myself. You know, I was up to over a half a bottle of vodka and two or three pills every night and falling asleep drunk and waking up and repeating the process over and over. And then almost just over 2 years ago, I woke up, I went to work. Everything was great. I left work a little bit early. It's normally what I would do if I couldn't wait till the end of my shift to take some pills. I'd, you know, being the lieutenant, it was easier for me to take time off. So I would just take 4 hours of vacation, go home early, then I could start taking my pills. And in this case, I'd gone to my mom's. I was hoping, I was running out. I was down to one pill and I had another 10 days left before I could get a refill. But, you know, my mom was always able to, you know, she didn't know I was addicted. She just thought she was helping me. But I just figured I'd go get some from her, but she didn't have any to give me. And I started to panic because I was supposed to leave in 3 days to Mexico on a family vacation slash wedding. And I didn't know what I was going to do because, you know, the first day, the second day of withdrawals aren't too bad. It's that third day off of the opioids when it really kicks in. And that was going to be the day I was going to be on a plane down to Mexico. And I was just thinking to myself, like, what am I going to do? I can't be on a plane going to Mexico sick. And, you know, hindsight, you could buy it over the counter down in Mexico. But, you know, when you're addicted, you're not thinking rationally anymore. And on my way home from my mom's house, the only thing that came up to me was go rob a pharmacy. Just go in there, give them a note, ask for the pain meds. I took Norcos. And that's what I did. I gave them a note. I said, this is a robbery. Give me your Norcos. Don't call the police. They didn't listen to the note, or they didn't read the note, apparently, because they called the police. And funny thing is, I sat there and I watched the pharmacist call the police. I saw her pick up the phone. I knew she was calling 911. I could see her giving my description, and I didn't even move. I just sat there. And eventually, they did give me a bag full of bottles. They gave me 9 bottles of Norco. And I walked out of the pharmacy and got about 20 steps, and the police showed up, and I got arrested. And that was rough. And I told them right off the bat I was a cop. They booked me into the county jail. While I was in the county jail, on 3 separate occasions, I went to go hang myself in the cell. But I didn't. I had a gun on me when I committed the robbery, but that was to kill myself. I had told myself if the police show up, I'm just going to shoot myself in the head really quick, so I don't have to go to jail. I wasn't going to make them shoot me. I wasn't going to do the suicide by cop. I wouldn't do that to my brothers and sisters, but I was going to do it to myself. Finding out later on, apparently I did reach for my gun on 2 separate occasions, and something stopped me. I think it was God, you know, looking out for me. So I get arrested. I get charged with the robbery. It takes about a year for me to get sentenced. I get sentenced to 3 years probation and a year in the county jail. Here in my county, you only do 6, you get 50% of your sentence. So I did 6 months in the county jail, all of that in protective custody. So I got 30 minutes a day out of my cell. Other than that, I spent the other 23 and a half hours in my cell every day. So I currently get to say I'm retired as a lieutenant, and at the same time, I'm a convicted felon, currently on felony probation. But in that process, you know, in the year it took to get sentenced, I did go to a 30-day program, got clean, got off the opioids, relapsed on the alcohol several times, just kind of waiting to go to jail. I wasn't dealing with it well, and I had kept telling myself the opioids were the real issue, the alcohol wasn't, and kept trying to justify drinking the alcohol. That didn't work. So I went into another 30-day program, came out. Then I went to jail. I came out of jail. And since then, I've been doing good. I had one relapse right out of jail with the alcohol the first day home. Not quite sure what that was about. Mainly, I think it was just the depression of having been in jail for so long. But immediately out of that, I got a therapist. And that's when we kind of started going over both childhood trauma and work trauma. You know, during my career, I was involved in 2 shootings. Just all the other stuff that, you know, first responders go through, the crime scenes that we have to see, and the other people's trauma that we have to deal with. You know, I didn't have that singular event, neither of the shootings I was in. I never had the typical flashbacks or nightmares or hyper vigilance. Mine was just a accumulation of everything, just all the incidents that I'd been through. And then on top of some childhood trauma is what build up to the PTSI. So, you know, the therapy has really helped a lot with that. I am a huge believer in therapy for first responders, and not at the point when they need it, at the point, really at the beginning of their career. I would recommend it. I think therapy is one of the best tools out there. You don't need to be in crisis to start seeing a therapist. I think it's a preventive measure that every first responder should take. Coming out of jail, I needed to do something with my life. I knew the jobs I thought I would get in retirement weren't going to happen anymore. I've never really had a problem public speaking. I actually had a partner once who rode with me. He was also my roommate, but we were riding together one night, and he told me that I could ride a whole shift by myself and still not run out of things to say. So I think he was right there. So I decided that I was going to go into public speaking and tell my story. and be vulnerable and let every first responder out there know that it's okay to ask for help. It's okay to admit that you're struggling. It's okay to take care of yourself. You don't have to take care of others all the time before yourself. So that's been my message. You know, I go out and I talk to police departments. I do guest appearances like this. I currently work for a company that actually provides assessments to first responders and that uses predictive analytics to evaluate first responders for mental health issues, for signs of PTSD, and law enforcement for signs of potential problems with misconduct. That has driven me quite a bit because it not only do I get to use my voice, I now get to use some Silicon Valley technology at my company to help first responders. And so that's just been my journey. And I'm just going to keep carrying this forward as often as I can.
That's a lot.
Yeah. It's quite the journey.
I don't even know. That's beyond the journey. Like when you got arrested, it was like in the height of the pandemic, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was in the height of the pandemic.
So I'm processing this information in my head. Do you think that that also contributed to where you were like mentally?
Yeah. I mean, the unit I was in charge of was, you know, our homeless outreach unit. And at one point I had 40 officers and 3 sergeants under me. So we were a pretty big unit. And, you know, even before COVID, we were dealing with a very vulnerable society, and addiction and mental health was a huge part of that. And that diversion program, you talked about the LEAD program, that is a pre-arrest diversion program. The idea behind that was when we contacted people that had a substance abuse problem and were committing crimes because of that addiction, on the one arrest that the officers were dealing with at that point, they could offer them to join the LEAD program in lieu of the charges. And then the charges would be held in abeyance for 30 days. And as long as they participated, the charges would be dropped. For me, the struggle was I would spend sometimes 2 weeks trying to talk someone into the program that I knew had an addiction problem. And then I'd go home and look at myself in the mirror and go, wow, you talk up a great game out there on the street, but you can't talk that same game to yourself. Like I was great at offering help. I was great at telling people you can't stop using drugs on your own. You can't clean up by yourself. You need to be in a program. And then every night I couldn't give myself that same message. You know, I guess I thought I was different. And then when COVID hit, we still had the same issues. We saw that same group that we had to deal with. And now we're exposing my officers to a much higher risk of COVID. But just dealing with that at work and dealing with that population and having a higher risk of it and just the politics and then, you know, having to get the vaccine. And yeah, I think it definitely was a contributing factor.
Okay. So you're still married, right? I mean, I would love to talk to your wife just to pick her brain. How was she handling this? I mean, and with your kids and you going to jail, how did she handle it?
It was rough. It was rough on her and my daughters. My daughters, right now, they're 26 and 17. So when this all happened, they were 24 and 15. And, you know, she knew about the alcohol. She suspected the pills, but didn't know. The night I was arrested, I was supposed to go pick up my daughter from cheer practice. And obviously I didn't show up and they didn't know where I was. And my wife was convinced that I'd finally killed myself because she heard me make the suicidal ideations. But then she had to deal, you know, with the phone call from the jail telling her what happened. And then, you know, we as a family tried to prepare as much as we could. I got taken into custody from court on December 23rd, 2 days before Christmas. We kind of knew my attorney was in talks with the DA's office and the judge was pretty confident that I was going to get county time and not state time, but I was going to have to do at least 6 months in the county jail. So we, you know, we were able to prepare for that in a way. We celebrated Christmas the weekend before just so we could have a celebration. My wife has a really large family. My wife's originally from El Salvador. My brother-in-law and his family live right next door to us. My sister-in-law lives 5 minutes away. And so her family really rallied around her and made sure she had a lot of support. And just our friends. You know, we have a lot of friends in the community that we live. A lot of the parents of the kids that my youngest went to school with here, you know, they all came by, they were bringing food, they were checking on them. So they had a lot of support, but you know, it's been hard. I mean, we still have our moments. I know she hasn't forgiven me yet, and that's going to be a long road for her. As hard as it is for me, I wish she could forgive me tomorrow, but it's going to be a while. But the fact that she stayed here by my side and that she stays supporting me and didn't leave me, to me, that's just another miracle of this story, you know, that I didn't kill myself, that I didn't, you know, do more harm, and that my wife and my girls have just been, you know, 100% supportive of me.
Because this was national news, right, if I remember correctly?
It was on every TV channel. It was in all the newspapers. And my first, you know, I get arrested Thursday. Friday, they take me up to the 30-day inpatient treatment. Saturday morning, I walk into the, you know, meeting room / lunchroom, you know, where we ate our meals. So I walk in the first morning for breakfast, and they have the TV on. And right when I walk in, there's the news story about me. There's my face on the TV talking about the officer being arrested. And I just turned around and walked right back out and went back to my room. But, you know, the program I went to is a great program. They, even though it's open to everybody, they have first responder competent therapist on site. And it's pretty much where every first responder in the San Francisco Bay Area will go for substance abuse issues. And about five people came to my room and pulled me out of the room. They're like, no, you're not going to sit in the room. You're going to go confront this. We're here to support you. And it was a great community. But yeah, they weren't going to allow me to just sit in my room and wallow in my own depression.
That's a lot to wrap my head around. So what do you think? Well, you kind of already said it, I guess. You said it's a lot easier to tell people to get help rather than actually convincing yourself to get help.
Yeah. You know, I always say the first responder community, I know it's similar in a lot of different professions out there, but I think just in particular in the first responder community, it is hard to ask for help. Unfortunately, and I'm sure you've heard it on your podcast and talking to others, there's still a lot of agencies out there that don't offer support that are, you know, I've heard stories of first responders going to the departments and saying, you know, I'm struggling with PTSD. And the next thing you know, they're being forced onto disability retirement. And it's that type of stigma, and the same thing with substance abuse. It's that type of stigma that makes it even harder for first responders to ask for help, because they don't want to lose their job. They just want to be healthy again. And, you know, I usually say PTSI instead of PTSD. I think the term really is post-traumatic stress injuries. It's an injury. It's an injury to the brain, and we know that. And just like any other injury, it can be repaired, and you could go back to work and it doesn't have to be a career-ending diagnosis for anybody. And nowadays, you know, with HIPAA laws, you don't even need to tell your agency. All you have to do is have your medical profession say, hey, this person needs, you know, X number of days off. And that's all these agencies should be asking. They shouldn't have to ask why someone's recommending that you be off for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month. And, you know, that's part of my advocacy, too, is to get these chiefs, both in police and fire and dispatchers, the EMS, to support their members, you know, and let them get the help that they need, because that's the most important thing. We can't continue to lose first responders to suicide. And a lot of these suicides, mental health is involved, substance abuse is involved. I'm not going to say it's a crisis, but this is something that's been left unaddressed for decades. You know, and it's just, I feel like in the last year or so, it's finally come to light, you know, and with podcasts like yours, where people are actually out there advocating for the well-being of first responders and bringing this and highlighting it so that we lessen that stigma and we lessen that, you know, guilt that you feel when you have an addiction problem and making it easier, you know, for everybody to seek out help and the help that they need.
Well, that's freaking insane. I don't know what else to say. It's a really interesting story about opioids and just addiction and overcoming that. So now you work for a company that helps with advocacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in police work. You have to take a psychological assessment to get hired. So it's the same model, except it's using advanced technologies and predictive analytics. And because the idea is, you know, we do evaluations of first responders to make sure they're mentally competent to be hired, and then we never evaluate them again. And we already know, we've known this again for decades, that this job has a cumulative effect on our psyche. But what tools are out there? You know, you could have a peer support program, you could try to encourage them to talk to someone, but to have a tool where they could sit down and do an assessment, you know, and within minutes themselves, their peer support group, or however their agency modifies it, could see in an instant how they look, and to be able to give this assessment periodically. We recommend quarterly, and you could see if there's any changes, and you could see after critical incidents, well, wait a minute, something's changed. Why is their assessment so showing a sudden score higher here when they never had that before? And it allows you to open these doors to conversation. So if it's someone who's reluctant, who may not even notice themselves that they're being affected by the traumas that they're being exposed to, you say, hey, there's something here. And then here's the help for you. Here's your peer support program. And then you take your clinician or your peer support people and say, hey, look at this person's assessment. Let's open that conversation and let's see what we can do to coach them down and get them the support that they need, with the idea of this being preventive. Let's not wait till it gets to someone like me where I'm addicted, or someone who's getting suicidal, or somebody because of their high stress, now they're using excessive force. Why not have a tool in place where you could foresee that and prevent it and do more for the health and the wellness of their members?
100% agree with you that why wouldn't we continually evaluate for mental health when we know that it's a huge issue within the first responder world?
Yeah. You should be going to therapy before you actually need therapy because of the job.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, therapy should be encouraged right out of the academies. You know, in the same tool, we could do a cultural DNA of a shift. We could look at a whole shift. We could take the whole shift's assessment and go, hey, there's something different with this shift than the other shift. So what's going on? Is it a busier shift? Are they not getting the leadership that they need? Is there somebody toxic in the group that's affecting the rest of the group? I mean, because we know these things also play into the overall psyche. It's all you got to do is have one bad boss, you know, and I've been through periods where I've had bad bosses above me that just shot my stress level up through the sky. And, you know, again, having a tool for someone to come in and go, well, something's going on with this particular shift or with this particular unit, and it allows the bosses to come in and be more proactive in these preventative measures and taking care of their members.
And you have a company that does that. So
it's great that it's out there. It's a new tool. And, you know, when they interviewed me for the job, knowing my full background, and I saw the tool, I was like, this is kind of a match made in heaven for me as far as what I'm doing and what I want to see accomplished in the first responder community.
Right. Okay. Unless Audra has any other questions, I'm going to switch it up to the hot seat. And it's going to be very brief today because we are running over our regular recording time because your story was impactful and we didn't want to cut it off. So if you are ready, two questions.
I'm ready.
Have you read any good books that you would recommend to our listeners?
Yes. Relentless Courage by Michael Sugrue. He is a sergeant out of the San Francisco Bay Area who's involved in a shooting and developed PTSD. I love the format of this book because it's each chapter, Michael talks about an incident. And then the second half of the chapter is Dr. Springer, his therapist, talking about how that affected Michael and how that looks for the first responder community. It's an excellent, excellent, excellent book. Second book, if you are looking into the 12-step program, Russell Brand, the comedian slash now talk show, he wrote a book about his sobriety. I don't have the title, but it's about the 12-step program. And I think it just appeals to first responders because he's very raw. I would recommend the audio version because he reads it himself. And if you know the 12 steps, it's, you know, I have a problem that I can't control. I need a higher power. He kind of breaks it down as I'm fucked up. And I need some fucking help, and I need a fucking higher power to take care of me. And I think I think first responders would get a lot out of that. I found that really got me more pumped up about the 12-step program than originally I had been. So off the bat, those are the two books I would recommend. But Relentless Courage for sure. Michael and Doc Springer did a great job with it.
Michael was actually on our podcast and did a wonderful interview with us, and the book is fantastic. So we 100% agree with that. Also, Russell Brand's book is called Recovery, for anyone wondering about that. Okay, last question. Two adjectives that you would use to describe yourself.
Think about this one for a second. Well, as of today, my two adjectives are, I'm going to say courageous, because it takes courage to tell the story and to get out there and to do it. And the other one is, well, strength. I've learned about an inner strength that I didn't know I had and that I doubted all these years. And having gone through all this, I realize I am much stronger than I ever thought I was.
I think Audra and I can agree that those are accurate adjectives for you.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Okay, Damon, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your story. Damon is available to speak to your agency or organization and can be reached at contactdavincole@gmail.com. You can also find him on LinkedIn by searching Damon Cole. And for more information on The Hire, you can visit thehire.net. As always, thanks for making us part of your day. If you love Dear Chiefs, please share our episodes with your friends, first responder families, and also leave us a review on any platform you stream our podcast to help others find us. Thanks for listening, and thanks for being with us today, Damon.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for tuning in. Find us on social media at Dear Chiefs Podcast and online at DearChiefs.com. Tune in weekly for the 25,000-foot view of loving a first responder. Audra and Chelsea, over and out.